This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
If there's any occupation that needs continuously updated education, it's medicine. With constant updates and advances, physicians need smart, innovative ways to keep pace.
Just the sheer amount of stuff that we're trying to teach people and we as individuals and professionals try to learn is often get in the way of storing it in an efficient way.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a look at new technology and adaptive learning for doctors. We'll also talk to a world-class architect about how some architectural tuning can make a city or town more functional and livable. And we'll also spend an academic minute seeing how architecture can make technology more functional, if not livable. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Recently, the New England Journal of Medicine partnered with a company called Area 9 Learning to create a platform with smart technology that adapts to clinicians' learning goals and knowledge gaps to deliver critical information they need. Area 9 Learning is a physician-led pioneer in adaptive learning, and Dr. Ehrlich Christensen is the chairman of the board of Area 9 Learning. He is also a member of the executive management team of McGraw-Hill Education, a team striving to reimagine education through adaptive and personalized learning. In addition to being trained as a physician, Dr. Christensen is an expert in learning technology, having pioneered advancements in adaptive learning, data-driven content development, computer simulation, and debriefing technologies. I spoke with Dr. Christensen recently about the trends he sees that will change medical education in the coming decades.
So over the last 20 years or so, we've been looking at how education could interact with avoiding human errors. I think that we're finally beginning to see some major trends that could impact that. But a lot of it is rooted in very fundamental education that goes way back into pre-graduate education.
Given your background in medicine and medical education, what can be learned from the research you've done in these and in other areas of interest?
I think there are a number of different things. The first one is that what I sometimes refer to the mountain of stuff, so all the sheer amount of stuff that we're trying to teach people and we as individuals and professionals try to learn is often get in the way of storing it in an efficient way. So both when we are originally trying to learn it, but also when we're designing curricula for people who are to learn it, we have to be more mindful, or we can probably benefit from being more mindful about the fact that there is a limited absorption capacity or a limited pace by which we can learn. And I think one of the most important things we've seen over the last years is that we're not very realistic about what we're capable of accomplishing in the educational system.
What about technology? What is its role in medical education moving forward?
So the biggest advances we've made have actually been right before we reach medical education. So in higher education, we have transformed with technology a lot of educational programs through introducing adaptive learning that is able to filter out some of the unnecessary practice, focusing learners who are not very good at deciding what they should focus on where they should spend their efforts. And we've also found that we, with advanced technology, are capable of making them better learners.
How far down that path have we already traveled?
In terms of medicine, we're not very far. We are further with the foundation subjects like microbiology, biology, physiology, anatomy, and that kind of things. We're quite far there. In terms of the more specialized medical areas, we're not that far. The only example of adaptive learning in medicine currently is New England Journal of Medicine's new maintenance of certification prep platform called Knowledge Plus. That one was quite an ambitious project when they started out, but it has turned out to be a much greater success than even I hoped.
Doctor, what are the biggest barriers to more efficient learning?
That's actually a really good question. The most important one, I think, is the ability to filter between important and non-important. But that has a number of different phases that shows each of their ugly heads at different phases of learning. So when you learn something the first time, it's great if you're capable of soon figuring out what I'm reading right now and I've seen for the first time, this is probably not very important, or this is really important. I really have to fit that in to the semantic framework in my head so I can find it later when I need it. But 2 weeks or 4 weeks later, it's also really important to be able to have that, the technical term is metacognitive skill, to be able to look back and say, this thing back there, I really didn't get, but I could really benefit from looking at this again now, or trying to understand that or comprehend that at an even deeper level. Because of what I'm doing now, I could really benefit from it. Great learners are really good at this. Weaker learners or slower learners are not very good at it. The technical term is deliberate practice, or has been proposed to look at this as a matter of deliberate practice. How good are you at practicing the things you do not yet master?
As we move forward, what will the costs be? What costs are involved, and will advanced tools eventually pay for themselves?
I think it depends on how you look at it, but I think there, it is a resounding yes. But it depends on what you count in as paying for it. So if you look at it from an individual learner's perspective, if some of the advanced technologies that we have done research in and pioneered over the last years definitely brings an enormous efficiency to learning something, particularly if it's larger areas like it is in medicine. So the amount of time you save, if you factor that in, yes, they will pay for themselves. If you think your time is free, they don't necessarily, not straight away at least. If you look at it from a from an educational system perspective, we know already now that they more than pay off or pay for themselves simply because of the reduction of failure rates or people who don't learn as they need to. So we know in higher education we can reduce the failure rates by about one-third, which is a massive impact. That means that in two or three decades, if we did this throughout the entire educational system, we could probably address the fundamental problem of $1.3 or $1.4 trillion of educational debt. So in terms of the economics of this, if you just factor in the appropriate contributions to value, I'm absolutely convinced that they can pay for themselves simply because they're capable of using some relatively or some time that is not used very efficiently today and use that in a highly, highly efficient way.
Preventing errors in medicine and the laboratory in particular is an ongoing endeavor. Are there any effects of more efficient learning on human factors or human errors?
That's interesting. That's where we started 20 years ago. We were thinking that we should look at this as a human factors problem, not as an educational problem. What became clear over the following decade was that it was a combination of things. It was both the human factors and human errors aspects we know from aviation, where it's really, really important that you collaborate with your teammates, that you build checklists, that you think about the world as something where we're not perfect and we will make errors and we have to be tolerant to human errors. But it also became clear through trying to address all these issues that there was a very, very big educational component of this, where we were building simulation environments where doctors and nurses, OR teams, ER teams, military, emergency medicine response teams, they were practicing how to become better teams. But we could also see how much of the time we were spending on knowledge. So we actually got into all the advanced technologies that are currently changing K through 16 or 17, how they're changing that world of education. They came out of trying to understand how do we get people to postgraduately improve. And the key to this is education. It is to change the way we learn things in the first place. It is to make people better learners or students better learners, help them navigate through the mountain of stuff, all these things we throw at them, but where they get lost and they don't know what's up.
What would be the best way to improve someone as a learner, teaching them to get to the top of that mountain of stuff or teaching them how to cut it down to size so it's not so big?
That's a simple answer. The most important single factor you can improve is getting better at knowing what you don't know. So a very concrete example is that in the adaptive systems we invented about a decade ago, we introduced the concept of asking you how certain you are about your answers. This simple thing of constantly figuring out, do I really know this, or am I guessing, or am I on in that unknown territory? If we can, and we know now that we can, but we thought back then, if we could make them better and faster at figuring out that they don't know this, we actually moved them from being unconsciously incompetent, which is pretty dangerous, into at least a zone of being consciously incompetent so that they're in the learning zone where they're able to improve. That thing alone of being consciously incompetent, knowing that I still need to learn something, and it's this I need to learn, is really, really powerful.
Dr. Ehrlich Christensen is the chairman of the board of Area 9 Learning and a member of the executive management team of McGraw-Hill Education. Still to come, does the architecture in your town need a tune-up? That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Sometimes just changing the architecture or design of a few buildings in a town can make that a more livable place. It's called architectural tuning, and it's something that Leon Cryer loves to talk about. Cryer is an architect, architectural theorist, and urban planner who's a leading proponent of what's being called new urbanism in architecture and community design. Cryer recently spoke about this at the Institute for Human and Machine Cognition in Pensacola, Florida. Later, he sat down with the Institute's communications manager, Carl Wernicke.
You lectured at IHMC about architectural tuning. What exactly is that?
Well, there's a lot of activity in building, which are to do with very, very different purposes, which are maybe production or religion or people being isolated or being in large communities. So there's very large difference of sizes and scales of building activity around a town, a country, the globe. And there's an understanding that all this activity is somehow miraculously ordered to make sense. But that's a delusion. Because most building which happens is done without, let's say, an idea what all this activity will end up it, what will be the shape which we'll end up having. And a lot of building activity of the last century was quite simply chaotic.
So have our communities gotten out of tune, or were they just never in tune to start with?
Well, it's a very colorful picture. For instance, Pensacola is now much better than when I was here 30 years ago. So some places become better, more attractive. And I couldn't imagine 20 years ago that Pensacola would become an attractive place. And now, just by having maybe 3 dozens of buildings restored and some new buildings which are behaving decently, which are finely tuned, let's say, it's a promise of a great place happening.
So was it the automobile that sort of shocked us out of tune with walkable cities?
Well, the automobile is just a symptom. It's not the cause. Clearly, there had been an energy coming in 200 years ago, which humans were not accustomed to, which is fossil fuel energies, and they have so much increased our power of production, but it hasn't increased our power of judgment, of aesthetic judgment, of planning judgment, so that we are in time of learning. And in a way, we are the first generation who tried to correct something which had gone terribly wrong.
Does this concept of tuning a community or a city and also achieving this aesthetic value, is that coexistent with an effective, efficient city?
Well, in order to tune, you need something. You need an instrument which is already well-built, well-configured, well-structured, and has a certain stability. Andreas Tuani, who is a famous planner in this country, who has developed the Urban Transect, which is an instrument how to order buildings according to location, or how to read a territory according to its shape, its size, you know, the densities and so on. And this tuning I talk about is more how all these building activities which builds towns and villages and hamlets, how that can be refined to really produce beautiful places.
Well, one of the parts of any city today, of course, is important is density. And I guess sort of a more modern concept has been that we want more density. But in researching your work, you're indicating that some of our big cities have simply become too dense. They've overloaded the streets, the infrastructure. Talk about the matter of density. I mean, a lot of people said that density was the way to avoid urban sprawl. And so people look at some of your work and say, well, he wants to spread things out again. But you're not talking about urban sprawl.
No, I not only talk about horizontal urban sprawl, which most people understand for suburbs to be, but also about vertical sprawl, that most of our city centers are already being excessively densified, which is actually a complement to the excessive horizontal spread, and where the city is something which is much more complex. It needs a specific size, a specific density, and specific shape in order to be efficient. So it cannot be going from one excess, from horizontal excess to vertical excess, but what is the right composition? And now as economic and human activities which a city generates are extremely diversified and don't want to be too much controlled, because otherwise you kill it. It needs some common sense, something which everybody agrees about, some rules which are like 10 commandments, which you don't go against without feeling bad or without knowing that you go the wrong way. And so you first need to know what is going wrong in order to put it right. And I think we are about to understand that in a phenomena like the metropolis didn't exist in pre-industrial, pre-fossil fuel age. So what is that phenomenon that it does not end up, if we go on building, to plan in terminal congestion? And so I think the understanding is that because humans haven't really changed in shape, there's some constant, both for what is a living room, but also what is a town square or what is an urban district or what is a metropolis, that you need to understand the limits, and beyond you just start another operation. You do not go on expanding the same town forever. You have to multiply rather than to overexpand.
So in other words, you have said you think the ideal height for buildings in cities is 3 to 5 stories, although those wouldn't necessarily be the same height of buildings because of variations in building. So given that sort of thing and the focus on density, you think it's better to have smaller clusters of density as opposed to one mega city?
Well, I understand the large city to be in a family of small cities. They all have their own character and they have some specific function, which is unique maybe, but they should all be so complete that the community which lives there, the 5,000 or 10,000 or 2,000 people who live there, can perform most of their daily or weekly activities on foot. That does not prevent you from doing other activities which are automotive or traveling, but at least that those things which you do normally in a regular and repetitive pattern should be able to, out of choice, do on foot. So it's a walkable city, not only horizontally, but also vertically.
Which means rejecting another one of our modern ideas, which was zoning that separated everything into certain areas. At one time, we believed we didn't want our shopping to be near our homes, to be near our schools, and we put them all in different areas, and then we ended up with having to drive everywhere.
Well, zoning is a very mysterious phenomenon which can be explained in certain fashions, but which became law even there where it was not necessary. It became necessary in the 19th century when industries were highly toxic and when terribly noisy, and so you wanted to separate them out. And there are certain production plants for cars you don't want to have in the middle of the city. It's too big. And so is an airport. But there is, by building urban communities of a limited size, between those communities, you have spaces which are of geographic nature for rivers, mountains, but also for exceptionally sized operations like airports. But you get a scale and a hierarchy which makes sense and which is legible by every intelligent customer, whereas now cities have become literally illegible. You need plans in order to, I mean, we were joking about the Pentagon, how impossible it is to find one's way, even if you have used it for a lifetime. But cities, in a way, have, you know very little about cities, whereas a legible city, you use it once and you know how it is geographically organized.
So to really be a friendly and efficient community, people should be able to easily know their way around.
Well, cities are for people, so you shouldn't really need a map in a daily fashion to get around your city.
Well, you had mentioned Pensacola and how much it's changed in 30 years, and certainly it has. You think we're headed in the right direction, or where do we need to go in the future?
Well, I'm talking about Pensacola, I know, which is just the two streets and squares in the center. I think when you look at it from an aeroplane, it is such a vast operation, which is mostly suburban. And I think it's this suburban expanse which in the future need to be reorganized. But I think the centers which become really much more complex and much more interesting and much more attractive artifacts will be the model of how to reform the suburbs.
How do you know when you've reached that tipping point in the, say, a city center where you're headed to where you want to go? Is it simply that suddenly people think, hey, I want to live there?
Yes, I think that's the best. I even felt this, going the five streets which are so attractive here, one could actually live here. Because once you have the right scale, a demonstration of the right scale, which is not just a survival of the deep past, but it's something new. It's renovated, but it's a new object which is used by young people and by old people, and everybody likes them and reveres them and wants them to be a model for what you want.
Leon Cryer is an architect, architectural theorist, and urban planner. He spoke with Carl Wernicke, communications manager for the Institute for Human and Machine Cognition in Pensacola, Florida. Architecture can not only be used to make cities and towns work better, it can help technology too. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Thinking like an architect has application beyond construction. I am Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College, and today on the Academic Minute, Robert Edgell, an assistant professor of technology management at SUNY Polytechnic Institute, explains the utility of collaborative thinking.
I've always been fascinated with creativity and innovation. I collaboratively conducted an ethnographic study of architects, and guess what? Surprisingly, they're not the lone creative geniuses portrayed in popular culture. Instead, we found that they do more than just design buildings alone. Architects work with others and deploy paradoxical cognition. This is a way of thinking used to arrive at acceptable trade-offs among messy, conflicting, and seemingly contradictory needs and constraints. Architects view these tensions arising from competing forces not as hindrances, but instead as opportunities to generate novelty and make better designs. Furthermore, architects collaboratively work through ensembles of diverse project constituents by using interpretive microprocesses, or IMs. IMs such as charrettes and prototyping assist with information robustness by enabling the collection of not only verbal or language-based information stored in the brain, but also nonverbal, gestural, or visual information. This improves novelty generation and decision-making by reducing the incidences of judgment biases. You might say the more robust the information, the better the decisions. Thus, seeing innovation through the eyes of architects provides insights about less obvious dimensions that contribute to a more complete theory of sustainable change. With the right involvement from constituents, durable and creative buildings emerge. The same can be said of any organization.
That was Robert Edgell of SUNY Polytechnic Institute. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm a slightly hoarse Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.